Welcome to the Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Booker Prize finalist Mark Haddon is the author of such books as The Porpoise, The Pier Falls, The Red House, and the internationally best-selling novel The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime. He now returns with Dogs and Monsters Stories, eight mesmerizing tales exploring what ultimately makes us human. Whether describing Laika, the Soviet space dog, on her fateful orbit, or St. Anthony wrestling with loneliness in the desert, his powers of observation are at their height when illuminating the thin line between human and animal, and it is a delight to welcome Mark Haddon to our book show. Thank you so much for being with us. What a great pleasure to have you aboard.
It's good to be here.
I've been a big fan of your work for a long time, so it's a real thrill to have you on the program. I've wanted to have you on the program for a while. Give us a sense of, we'll get into the story, I assume, but give us a sense of how this particular collection came about, because it was somewhat circuitous.
The short answer is slowly and piecemeal. I was unfortunate. Well, I say unfortunate. I had a triple heart bypass almost on the day that my last novel was published, which is inconvenient to say the least. The fortunate side of that is that I knew something was wrong before I had a heart attack, and me and some excellent doctors got me into hospital and got me patched up. And that meant that whilst my body recovered very quickly, the brain, as everyone knows who's been through major surgery, was just beset by fog for a long time afterwards. And that was made worse by a series of other fogs after that, including COVID and then long COVID, from which I'm still crawling out from under. So some of the stories were written before, a couple were written in the gaps in that fog, and the rest were sort of edited and pulled together when my brain was able.
Give us a sense of the what it was like to be in that fog, of how that felt.
It's very difficult. I always say, and I'm perhaps being rather rude to dentists and car mechanics here, but I feel if I had a 9-to-5 job, which involved just physically doing things, I could have done it. But being a writer involves thinking. It involves reading and thinking clearly and juggling ideas. And that became very, very difficult. It was best described by a friend of a friend who'd had chemo, which induces a very similar fog, as people would know if they'd been through it. And she said, I used to have a very large table in my head, and I could put many things on the table and see them all in one glance and move them around and see the relations between those things. After chemo, I had a very small table. I could put two or three things on the table, I add something new to it, and one of the original things would fall off. And that's what it was like. It was like having a very small table in my head. And one thing about writing both short stories and novels is that you need a big table. You need to see the relationship between lots of things. You need to see the story as a whole. And, you know, that was almost impossible.
One of the things that about this time, which first of all is 5 years, so this is a long time. This is a very, very long period in your life. But not only is it hard to write, but you're having trouble. You're unable to read a book at points during this.
It's coming back now, and I'm reading regularly again, and it's a delight to be back. But yes, this. I spent a lot of time doing the New York Times spelling bee and staring at the wall. And I miss that. I miss that reading. I mean, you can't write if you're not reading. It's rather like going to a dinner party and expecting everyone else to listen to you without listening to them. You know, writing is for me a product of reading. You've got to put the stuff in to get the stuff out. So without reading, it's not going to happen. And yeah, not being able to read, I felt I'd been expelled from my secret kingdom.
You were talking about your medical care and the great medical care you had. Were you aware of what could possibly happen of the fog, what's often called pump head, that you are going to be changed in a way?
For me, when that came along, you know, when you see the Grim Reaper standing in your doorway, getting through to the other side is the important thing. The sense of being changed is a sort of secondary issue. And I knew from early on that I'd come out the other side, and that was the most important thing. And I was right. I still feel like me.
So you would there were things that you were writing. You would basically assign yourself exercises to try to write and write tiny things. And what was that like in the frustration? Because even if it was tiny, if you could succeed, it seems like it would be pretty monumental and special.
No, I thought of doing that for a while, rather like physio when you suffer a physical injury. I thought maybe I could gently exercise my brain back to writing level, but I couldn't because there's something very undermining and unsettling about writing a small bad thing. I'd rather write nothing than write something small and bad. For some reason, you need a big view. You need a quite a panoramic view to even make a paragraph work. A paragraph is like one of those complex mobiles hanging from the ceiling. You know, you poke one end of it and the whole thing starts to shake. But you have to get it all right.
Well, one of the things I also found fascinating is that basically you were told that in the best case scenario, often what happens is you need a year, and then once that year is up, you can start getting back to some normality. And for you, it was just about a year.
It was just about a year. I had a moment of clarity, and then I've been on mood stabilizing drugs for a long time, and those weren't quite working, and those needed tweaking. So I spent a long time going through the buffet of available drugs to find the right ones, and then had some clarity after that, and we got the right ones, and then along came COVID for the third variety of fog. I've become a connoisseur of fogs over the last half decade.
Mark Haddon is our guest. The name of the new book is Dogs and Monsters Stories, and the stories are incredible. It's hard to believe, however, that even when you, especially when you read these, so you're out of that fog after 12 months, and before the fog returns, you write two short stories. One is a version of the Minotaur myth, which is set in Elizabethan England, and the other is your version of the Temptation of Saint Anthony. Both of these stories included in the book are just phenomenal and so incredible, and it seems very difficult to believe when you're reading them because of the linguistic complexity that there would have been a fog in your very recent past.
What can I say but thank you? Writing is a bit like acting, I think. Once you get it right, the audience is utterly convinced. If it's not convincing, don't do it. But when writing works, it's always an illusion. You've always managed to cast a spell. You've convinced an audience that it's really working. And often, for me, the measure of a story starting to work is when I read sections back and it feels just right. I found myself always reaching for the image of shutting the door of a heavy, well-engineered German car, that heavy clunk as the door goes onto the latch. If I read back a story and I'm getting that satisfying clunk of things in the right place, then it works.
So even when the fog had lifted, you write these two stories in particular. I mean, there's still time, obviously, then you're working on them after that. Was the version that you had after that pretty much what we read in the collection?
No, I'm someone who edits many, many, many times. I often say that I'm a sort of a mediocre writer, but a very good editor. Maybe I'm doing myself down a little, but there is some truth in that. My first drafts are always clumsy and amateurish, and every sentence I've written that works has had a fine tooth comb through it 30, 40, 50 times.
Well, that's regardless, not because of any fog or that's just the process that you go through. When did you realize that you were working on a story collection, that this was the active project that you were working on?
Do you know, I can't honestly remember now. I looked back and I had about 10 stories. Two of them needed sort of taking out behind the barn and putting out of their misery. But the eight we had felt sufficient and felt that they made a satisfying shape.
When you have that satisfying shape, I mean, there seems to be very much a theme here, or at least stories that work well together. And I'm interested in how you would describe that of the feel of the book, of how these stories, what these stories as a collection tell us.
I'm almost tempted to say, well, that's your job, really, because I didn't have a sense of something connecting them. What connects them is my way of thinking and feeling about my imaginative universe. And I lay them one against another, and readers read them and make connections. And often those connections are surprising to me. From the inside, what connects them is principles that I find really important. Those would be, I think, an attempt to be humane, an attempt to put myself in the shoes of people who are very different from me, and also to give life to people who are very different from me. Someone asked recently about self-expression in stories, and I had never really thought about this before. I don't write to express myself. I write to get away from myself. I mean, middle class white men of my age have written, have taken up too much of the limelight for quite a long time. So, and lives like mine, I don't find terribly interesting in fiction. So, if I'm going to entertain people, I want to make a real effort to take them somewhere completely different, to generate new worlds and new characters, and give myself to that. So, it's less a case of self-expression as, in some ways, it's escaping from my life.
So I was fishing a bit in the last question, but ultimately I am curious because there is this connection with Greek myths, and I'm interested of what brought you down that path, how much that had to do with what you were going through, and also just the natural inclination to want to write about that.
I think, well, there are myths and there it. I generically tend to refer to them as old stories. They're kind of myths, they're fables, they're stories taken from novels and stories that we all half know. There are two different things which appeal to me about them. One is that for the audience, even if you haven't read certain stories, they will set off a kind of deep chime in the back of your mind. You might not have read Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, but if you hear the story, it resonates somewhere deep down because it's sort of part of a very loose cultural wallpaper. So for me, you set off that chime in a reader's imagination. But I'm really interested in going back to those stories and not retelling them, but in some ways having an argument with them. All stories are created within a society that has a certain power structure. They all tell one set of people's version of events. And I really like going back to those stories and saying, what about the people in the background? What about their humanity? What about their point of view? Where are the holes in the story? Where are the voices we haven't heard? And turning them around. I very much did that with The Porpoise, my last novel. But also here, you refer to the mother story, which is a sort of version of the Minotaur. And I thought, let's see it from the position of someone who is described as a monster. Let's turn it round. Let's use that old story, but let's flip it inside out and do something different with it.
I mean, you did that in The Pier Falls as well. That was your first story collection. Variations on myths, really riffs on various legends and myths as well.
There's a the mother who is the eponymous narrator of the mother story says something at the beginning of at the end of that story when she talks about whenever she hears sort of dazzling stories now, she wonders what is it that her attention is being directed away from by that dazzle. and that charisma. And I think that's my point of view. I enjoy the dazzle of those stories, but a little cynical part of me is asking, what are we being sold and what is being hidden while we're being shown this one thing? It's a kind of magic trick in these old stories. Let's lift the curtain and look at the sort of the dirty mechanism behind it.
So let us talk for a moment about the presence of dogs in the stories and in your work in general, of what is not only the fascination, but what is enjoyable for you in writing about that species.
I joke that I am genetically about 85% dog. I twitch when I'm going to sleep. I have an extremely strong sense of smell. And when I'm not suffering from long COVID, I like nothing more than a long run through muddy woodland in the rain. I do feel very much like a dog. Someone said to me recently, in fact, the writer Frances Spufford, whose wonderful book, Cahokia Jazz, was out about the same time as mine. He was interviewing me recently. We're talking in public. And he said, does the dog relate to some kind of wildness? And I don't think it does. I think the dog is a sort of avatar for me. Dogs aren't wild for me. Dogs are like a mirror of us. I think when we talk about nearly all animals, we are talking in some reflected, twisted way about ourselves. And dogs give me, I think, a different approach to talking about people.
Because it's that look at the difference, the differences between man and beast, and what is mortal and divine and real and not real. Those are all entryways that you explore.
Yeah, and there's a story, Dogs, which sort of tackles this head on. It's the story, well, originally I borrowed it from Ovid's Metamorphoses. The story of, it's one of these stories that people vaguely know at the back of their heads. The hunter Actaeon stumbles on the goddess Diana bathing, and in punishment, she turns him into a stag and he's eaten alive by his own dogs. The most fascinating thing for me about that story, and this will strike anyone who's read it in translation or in the original, is that those dogs, the whole pack of hunting dogs, are given names and pedigrees. And it's one of those moments in classical literature when you realize, my goodness, they were just like us. They gave their dogs names, they loved them, they felt close to them, their dogs felt like members of the family. And what happens in the story is that when the dogs eat their master, who's just seen a goddess, who's just experienced the divine, they go on throughout history, down the millennia, to become the dogs we know and love. And they contain in them some aspect of both the human and the divine. And that's what they are for me. Dogs are a sort of exterior part of ourselves.
And that ending with Laika, the first dog going into space, that allows you to really end the story in such a moving and fascinating way.
Yes, it's a terribly sad sort of heroic story, isn't it? That poor dog up there. I remember as a child reading about Laika, who was treated as if she was yet another cosmonaut, but then you realise that she was a street dog. The Russian space agency got street dogs, so they thought they were hardy and tough, and they trained them in some fairly grim ways to get used to being fired into space. And she didn't have a choice about it. So she's on the one hand sort of quite heroic, but it's also humans torturing an animal for research. It goes both to the most glorious and the most unpleasant aspects of human beings' desire to reach out into the unknown.
The new book is Dogs and Monsters: Stories by Mark Haddon. I have to say my favorite story in the collection is My Old School, and about a 70s boarding school, and where someone faces really the consequences of their actions. And that seems like it's such a it's so universal in how, at least it reached me, of how easy it is to feel this and to realize what's going on here, and how and to the point of thinking about our actions, which I just thought was quite extraordinary.
I resisted writing this story for quite a long time. English, particularly English literature is full of stories of boarding schools, and upmarket men and their teenage years. And I didn't want it to have that heritage gloss to it. And I thought too many of those stories have been told. But on the other hand, I was getting older, and I think I had interesting things to say about those institutions. And those institutions produced a lot of the men in particular who are now running the country in one way or another. So it felt like an important story to tell. So it's fiction, but there's a lot of my own teenage years in there when I was sent away to a boarding school. I mean, I was sent away by a father who, both my parents started from very, very, very working class families. He made quite a bit of money by being a very good draftsman and becoming an architect. And in truth, I think he sent me away to that school because he really wanted to turn the clock back and go to that school himself. He couldn't, so he sent me in his place, about which I was not too pleased. But I think that made me a very acute observer of what was going on at that place. I went in as an outsider.
I find that fascinating, but do you think he ever regretted that decision, seeing how you managed through your time in that school?
I have very little idea what was going on inside his head. Or I'm only able to guess. I do know that he would have loved it. I mean, he was a very good sportsman. He boxed, he sprinted, he swam, he played water polo. He was a very good rugby player who played for, didn't quite get a cap for England, but he played for the Harlequins and Leicester and Northampton, some sort of top-ranking English rugby clubs. And he enjoyed his national service. And I think he would have been in his element because the school was rather like national military service, with sort of lots of violent physical sport, cold showers, and if you join the cadet force, you could even get to fire a gun as well.
Always fun, right?
Yes.
When you look at your work, and I guess how people relate to it, it seems as though for many of us, you came onto our radar with a curious incident of The Dog in the Nighttime. What did that book mean to you, and how you look back on it and the whole ride that it provided you?
It almost doesn't seem as if it belongs to me now. It's rather like a stately home sitting on the hill in the distance. I used to say it's rather like a sort of, your books are a little bit like your children, but Curious now feels like a sort of very robust 35 years old that is looking after itself out there. Doesn't need much input from me. And you know, just occasionally we check in with each other. It has the most extraordinary life. And I suppose one of the honest answers is that I've had to detach myself from it a little because it does look after itself. And my career could be simply as the author of Curious Incident. And in fact, I've had to stop doing curious related events just so I can have the space in my head to think about other things and create other things.
And what's fascinating about that, because there's your work, the novel, and then of course the stage adaptation, which then has its own life, and but is very different and removed from what you were responsible for.
Yes, and in fact, interestingly, only we can see this, but the stage life of the book is even busier and more widespread than you might think, because it's being put on all around the world in
All
many
over,
different languages. I think And this is I'd never planned any of this, obviously. Curious is very loosely attached to the English language because of the nature of Christopher's voice, because he's not a lover of language, because he doesn't indulge himself in playing the instrument of the language, as it were. You can lift what he says out of English language and you can drop it into another language, I think, without losing much, if anything. You lose a few of the sort of slightly comic British references to place names, and games and surnames, but essentially the thing is still there. And I think that's purely by chance one of the reasons why it translated well to stage and why it's translated well into other languages, both on the page and on the stage as well, for which I'm hugely grateful.
So let me end with this question, which is a simple one, and I hope and I hope a good one in the sense of but you're feeling better.
I am, fingers crossed, I'm reading and writing. I'd quite like to go for those long runs in the woods, but I'm happy for the moment just to be reading and writing.
And which is brought on by the question of, do you feel you have what you want would want to have in your utility belt to be able to write a novel?
I'm keeping a little quiet about it for the moment, but I have written another book, not a novel, a small other book. So if I can do that, then I think I can do a novel.
Excellent. The
Stay.
name of the new book is Dogs and Monsters Stories. It is published by Doubleday. Mark Haddon, what a delight to have you on the program. I wish you well. I hope your health continues to improve and strengthen, and I so appreciate you being with us.
It's really good to be here. Thank you.
Mark Haddon's new novel is Dogs and Monsters Stories. It is published by Doubleday. Thanks to our producer, Sarah LaDuke. Write to us at book@wamc.org. The latest on national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter at wamc.org and on social media at WAMC Radio. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.